Hey everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. And in this episode, we interview Tom Parker, National CEO of the Australia-China Business Council, or the ACBC, discussing the evolving dynamics of Australia-China relations and the expanding opportunities for Australian businesses in China. We kick things off with an introduction to the ACBC, outlining its mission, membership, and the vital role it plays in supporting Australian businesses looking to enter or expand their presence in the Chinese market. Tom also discusses recent positive shifts in the Australia-China relationship, including the significant impact of the Australian Prime Minister's state visit to China in November, and the recent removal of Chinese tariffs on Australian wine, which marked a pivotal moment in improving trade relations. We then turn the conversation to the broader implications of these warming ties, identifying key growth opportunities for Australian companies in sectors beyond wine. Tom highlights the enduring popularity and positive reputation of Australian consumer brands in China, delving into why products from down under resonate so well with Chinese consumers and which sectors are currently thriving. From a domestic perspective, Tom shares insights into the sentiment of the Australian business community towards China, reflecting on the challenges and optimism prevalent among entrepreneurs and corporations. He also discusses the overarching message that ACBC is promoting within Australia to foster a supportive environment for bilateral cooperation. Enjoy.
Australia and China have a really strong, I guess, mutually beneficial economic relationship. So we dig stuff up, we send it, they make it, we buy it back. And certainly our close economic relationship with China certainly helped us stave off some of the issues that a lot of the world had around the financial crisis from subprime, even the Asian economic crisis back in 1997. So, you know, our engagement and our close links with China economically have been really beneficial for us and likewise, I think, for China. And there's a complementarity that I think both countries understand.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Tom, welcome to The Negotiation Podcast.
Thanks, Todd. Pleasure to be here.
Let's start. Standard opener. What city are you recording this episode from today?
I'm here in Melbourne, in the south of Australia. So, yeah.
All right. Nice. Okay. Introduce a little bit about the ACBC, the Australia-China Business Council, to the audience for us. Paint a picture of the membership and tell us about the work that you're doing.
Thanks, Todd. So the Australia-China Business Council, or ACBC, is Australia's premier, I guess, bilateral business chamber or organisation that helps Australian businesses better engage and understand with China, as well as assisting Chinese businesses and organisations invest into Australia. We're 50 years old, had our 50th anniversary last year, and were formed 1 year after the normalisation of relationships between Australia and China in 1973. The council is made up of corporate membership, and we have branches in each state and territory across Australia. So I sit over all the branches, and we have a national board, as well as in each of those states, we will have, a local executive committee, as well as an executive team. So we have roughly about 500 plus corporate members, and they're everything from your BHP, your Rio Tintos, your natural resource companies, through to smaller wineries, or even to people doing e-commerce between Australia and China.
You can tell me to move on in the questioning if you want, but something you said struck me as interesting, and I don't know how much of a history buff you are around it, but the normalization of relations, 1973, I've never had anybody bring that up before. Right. I'm kind of interested in what that actually is. Can you briefly us a little bit about what that meant?
Yeah. So modern China's history after, I guess, the fall of the Qing dynasty went into, I guess, what you would call a Republican era. And that was interspersed with the interwar years. And as many people would know, Japan invaded China in 1937. And roughly around those times, there was a civil war between the Republican and the Communist Party. At the conclusion of the Second World War, Chiang Kai-shek and the Republican, I guess, party and teams transitioned and moved across to Taiwan and set up there. And in the meantime, China was on the 1st of October 1949, was established as the People's Republic of China. Through that interwar period, the Republic of China, which was Taiwan, was recognized by the UN and by the US. What had happened in the interwarring periods, but during the Cold War in relation to some of the escalating tensions between Russia and the United States, China, particularly through Zhou Enlai, who was the premier, and to a lesser extent Chairman Mao, and the work that Dr. Henry Kissinger did, I guess by having a tighter and closer relationship with China, it de-escalated the tension between America and China. So when we call a normalization of relationships, what it really meant was that I think it was initially they called it ping pong diplomacy, but a ping pong team visited America. That started, I guess, the conversations in the back alley, not back alleys, the back channels. And through that, I think it was President Nixon that, I guess, formalized and normalized the relationship between the United States and China. Australia was actually went to China, well, the leader of our opposition party went to China in 1971, and then he was elected into government in 1973. And one of his first things that he did was to, I guess, to establish relationships, diplomatic or normalized relationships with the People's Republic of China, which was in 1973, which was just 1 year after the US. And our organization was born 1 year after that, when we took a trade mission, not me, not that old, when our forebears took a trade mission of 16 businesses to China, and the government, our government, the Australian government, felt that there needed to be an auspicing or an organisational body that could be set up to help facilitate trade between the two countries, and that's we're not-for-profit, non-independent and non-government-aligned business chamber.
I'm so glad that I actually asked that question. And that was that. And it's great for those who are listening. That was a completely off the cuff. Tom had no idea that was even coming. And then just crushed it. Just knocked it out of the stadium. So,
thank you so much
for that.
Hopefully it's like, you know, when you see those documentaries and you look stuff up. So maybe people can look all that stuff up and maybe some of my dates, my times or something, but that's the broad picture. Hopefully I got it right. But yeah, that's where it
Man,
sits.
You're going to be narrating BBC specials on this kind of stuff later. That was awesome. Okay. Right. So over the last year, there seems to have been, and I don't think we're putting words in anybody's mouths by doing this, although we are, a general warming of Australia-China relations, to say. Okay, so what's your pulse check on that current state of the bilateral relationship? And secondarily, what do you think are the factors behind that positive shift?
So absolutely. I mean, to provide a little bit of context for your listeners, Australia and China, I have a really strong, I guess, mutually beneficial economic relationship. So we dig stuff up, we send it, they make it, we buy it back. Certainly our close economic relationship with China certainly helped us stave off some of the issues that a lot of the world had around the financial crisis from subprime, even the Asian economic crisis back in 1997. Our engagement and our close links with China economically have been really beneficial for us and likewise, I think, for China. And it's a complementarity that I think both countries understand. There had been some tensions politically since about 2018. the Australian government passed a law which was called the Foreign Interference or Transparency Law. And really what it was trying to do was looking at and protecting, foreign actors or bad state actors involving and engaging in activities that might influence, government or other things. Whilst it wasn't directly targeted at China, I think China certainly felt that it was. And our former Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, stupidly quoted Chinese Mandarin in Parliament. And generally when you do that and you don't speak the language and you don't understand the context, it can cause offence. But he sort of said that Australia had Dunti Lied, which means stood up to China. And that's famously the first line of the Chinese national anthem. It's also what Chairman Mao said on the rostrum of Tiananmen when he declared the opening of the, or the establishment of the People's Republic of China, where he basically said, "We, China has qi lied, has stood up." So that started the process. Then another government, another conservative government in Australia, questioned and wanted to ask, some thought appropriately, but certainly perhaps not in the diplomatic way or through the diplomatic channels, sort of an investigation into the outbreak of the coronavirus, which again caused great offence. As a result, there became a bit of a tit for tat economic coercion, where I think the market access for some Australian goods and services were restricted through a rules-based process, through tariffs. Others were through beliefs that there had been issues with safety and security. And, it caused a huge impact, I think, not so much economically, but I think politically as well as culturally between our two countries, who had, I think for a lot of Australians, they had a very benign relationship with China. You know, it was sort of seen as a country that offered, economic opportunity as well as friendship. And there wasn't that polarization that we often get from an ideological perspective that sometimes perhaps predates that Cold War process between America and China. We had a change of government from a conservative to a Labor government, which is perhaps a bit more like the Democratic Party in the States. And they've traditionally had a better and closer relationship with our Asian neighbours. And I think perhaps what they did is they just went about it in a more pragmatic approach. They really reinstated some of the diplomatic channels and got to work on establishing and rebuilding that relationship. I also think that China also felt that some of the policies they perhaps put in place inadvertently hurt them and their economy as a result. And so there was a sort of a coming to the table. I also think, globally, globalization, there's a lot of proponents and people feel that with all a lot of countries, regardless of trade, is a global thing. But, there's been a closing of borders. Someone at a conference just recently said it was a really good point. When we're all locked up in our houses, and in Melbourne we're in the longest lockdown in the world pretty much, I think 230 days during COVID, that suspicion kind of crept in, mistrust. And when you can't see each other, when you can't be face-to-face and you don't have that dialogue, sort of things fall away. And so I think that was part of it as well. So I think it was partly the context. I think partly it was some of the decisions of both the Australian government and the Chinese government. And I think as a result of that, what's come from it is been a change of government. But I also think, both sides have wanted to look at how do you stabilize that relationship. And certainly the Australian government's got a very clear kind of framework, which is sort of work where we can, and disagree where we must. And so I think what we've seen has just been kind of an easing off, partly because of the context, but also because of the change of government.
as any good interview show does, we tend to follow the heads of state, the major political figures as they travel around the world and then ask about their goings on. And we know that the Australian PM just recently had a state visit to China in November.
Yeah.
What has been any of the outcomes, positive developments in the wake of that visit that you can talk about?
Yeah, well, I think the most important one is that he was there. So it was the first time in 7 years that an Australian Prime Minister had been to China and also to meet with Xi Jinping. And I think that for a lot of Australian businesses in the broader community, they don't really understand the symbolism of what that actually means. And I think that whilst some of the policies that were put in place by the Chinese government were quite, they were registered with the WTO, they were quite clear what they were doing. A lot of it was also just, you know what, Australia's on the nose. You know, from a Chinese perspective, we don't want you to kind of, Australia's in the bad books, so we don't really want you to engage with them. And I think what that means is that businesses and distributors and retailers, what they felt is like, oh, I better not piss off people. So I'm just going to, it's too hard. It's too complicated. If I wanted to, and if you wanted to get red wine, beautiful Australian red wine, you could still, you just had to pay a lot of money for it in China. But what it meant was that when this visit happened, it kind of gave a green light to everyone. It's like, hey, the boss says Australia's okay. We're back on. And I think as a result of that, what we've seen, and literally the Australia-China Business Council, our phones and our emails kind of went hot from literally the day after. People, we had a huge delegation of vice governor of Zhejiang province come down literally 3 days afterwards with 40 people. And so I think what it created was kind of the approval, even though it wasn't said, okay, everyone, you can, it's okay. But what it did symbolize was that there was that opportunity now that we were going to talk again. We were going to find constructive ways to work together and work coherently. Oh, and I think, sorry, the outcome from it was also they created something called a joint statement of outcomes, which was looking at a couple of areas that both countries really wanted to focus on. And interestingly, some of those were things like climate change or climate smart agriculture. And some of the tariffs and some of the goods that had issues with market access were going to come off as a process of that.
Now, you mentioned a nice glass of Australian red wine. What is the status of Australian wine in China?
Yeah, so as of the end of March, there are all the tariffs that had been put on Australian wine have now been lifted. So the pre-tariff prices means that, as I said, wine was still available, but it was just prohibitively expensive. I think the tariffs were over 200%, which makes it very difficult to compete with great Californian or European or South American wine or New Zealand wine. So now that that's there, and I guess trades resuming between the two, but similar to how in a lot of industries that were sort of shut down during COVID, it takes a while to get the wheels turning, to just getting those orders, to getting people back on the grounds, finding those distributors again, and working together. But yeah, no, the wine trade's back on.
Well, I just think generally speaking for Australian businesses and brands, all arrows are pointing up right now, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that even just figuratively up the map. I mean, just looking really, really good. So
I think a lot of people don't realize just how much we export to China. So 40% of the value of all of our exports goes to China, or it was sort of pre-COVID. So there's been a real push to diversification just from a supply chain risk perspective. But that's now down. It got down to just under 30%, about 29% in 2021, and it's now back up around 34-35%.
Do you know, and I just remember this from years ago, and I haven't looked it up recently, and I mean years, like 10 years ago, but is China net exporting or net importing these days?
It's net importing against us.
Yeah.
And that's really based off the value of our iron ore.
Yeah.
The other thing too, Todd, is that sort of a third of that value is really one product. it's iron ore, you know. So almost $100 billion worth of trade value that goes to China is iron ore that goes into the steel mills that, you know, has helped fuel, I guess, the development and the urbanization of China and the growth of their economy, which has helped our economy.
China still produces, I think, somewhere 80% or north of rare earth metals, which is kind of key to microchips and all our cell phones and everything like that. But they are still reliant on a lot of the other components, iron ore being one of them for sure. Quickly touch on other main growth areas and opportunities for Australian companies in China.
Well, I think it's also partly linked in to iron ore. So, you know, we're as a globe on a pathway to net zero. We have to, you know, to address climate change, to address, you know, what's been happening. And as a result, what I think the greatest opportunities that we're looking at is where is that what we call the green channel between Australia and China, which is something that the Australia-China Business Council in 2022 put up, which we felt, given where we weren't really talking to each other, there was still an agreement that we could talk, and similar to the joint outcomes, or the joint statement of outcomes that came from both leaders' meeting, was that, you know, climate action and action towards, you know, decarbonisation is something that both are in both our countries' interests. So, how do we make the steel, China's steel industry, emit less? Because it's a huge emitter. The dairy cows that go into the milk that goes to China, or the infant formula, you know, livestock, and we have not just dairy; we obviously have beef, which also gets exported to China. You know, it's the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases in Australia is livestock. So how do we look at the abatement of those things? So I think where the greatest opportunities might be is we've got this incredible technology or kind of innovation where we're harvesting seaweed that we put into cow feed that then stops them farting as much, which means there's less methane, which means there's less gases. You know, and something as simple as that, even though it's not simple, it's been, you know, developed, how we export that and how we engage with China's dairy farmers or how we engage with their consumers, that's where the opportunities are. And so we're seeing some great growth in that space that's not just a transactional relationship, that it's kind of a knowledge sharing and it's a relationship-based process. And that's something that we at the ACBC really value and have been doing for a long time. From an advocacy perspective, is how do we engage, you know, with the consumer in China from an Australian perspective, but also make it more than it's just transactional. But you know, I think there's some opportunities in that particular space. I also think Australia really does well at selling health and happiness, even though I might not look like a picture of either. But, you know, the happiness might be the red wine. It could be a nice cut of beef. And the health is – or both. Actually, together they're really good. You know, but then – and then the happiness can also be tourism inbound coming here. I think the health is what we're talking about around some of that the green channel and the green economy opportunities, but also it's things like Australian supplements – vitamins, our med tech have also been kind of well received and well regarded. And I think if anything, I think Chinese consumers have a picture of Australia, even if they haven't visited here, of one of Australia being kind of abundant in sort of sunshine and health and sort of outdoors. And obviously, we have our own health challenges, like a lot of Western countries. But I think that while it's a bit hackneyed to kind of keep talking about the clean and green aspect of Australian or even New Zealand products, I still think it resonates in that market. And I think there's opportunities if brands or services fit within those kind of parameters. That's a really easy kind of unique selling point for a lot of Australian brands into China anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You think about Australia. I mean, it's a mix of mostly Baywatch everywhere with a mix of Crocodile Dundee and Foster's, but then a big swath in the middle where they just consistently shoot Mad Max movies. You know, that's right. That's kind of like what you think about.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about consumer brands, because they haven't really been too affected
by
market access restrictions. So maybe you could talk about some of the more popular Australian brands that are doing well in China, and then why. I mean, I know that you just touched on the health, and I mean, continuing to kind of unravel why Australian brands resonate so well with the Chinese consumer.
I mean, it's really interesting. I think a lot of it also comes back to people-to-people exchange. And by that, what I mean is that China was, and will be again shortly, Australia's sort of leading source of tourists. But the tourists that come are often what we call VFR, which means visiting friends and relatives. So they're visiting their aunties, their uncles, their kids who are at university, and they're staying on average for 27 nights, which is a good stay, as opposed to we get group tours that are here for 48 hours and they do the usual sites and then go on to New Zealand. But the thing that we know with Chinese tourists is that they are by far and above the largest spenders because of the gifting culture of China. And what that means is that they on average spend between, again, this is pre-COVID figures, about $7,500 Australian dollars per tourist, which is more than the next three countries combined. And what they're doing is they're buying Australian products. They're buying UGG boots. They're buying sheepskin products. They're buying Swiss or Blackmores vitamins. They're buying foodstuffs. And what that does is that it then enables those brands to have, I guess, familiarity and in a way almost that grey channel of what was, it's pretty much over the Daigo market or the overseas buyer shopper market. But, you know, for Australia, that was a huge, you know, I think if you look at some of the vitamin companies and even the infant formula companies, they were making so much money off domestic sales that were actually ended up going into parcels, boxes, and being sent back to China. And I think the brands and the opportunities are those that appeal, that then tie into kind of that lifestyle of Australia and also the products that you don't quite see. So whether it's a cereal brand, whether it's a type of biscuit, whether it's if it's a type of beverage or a tea, you know, there are lots of things. We had a lavender bear that went bananas. Like it was a bear that was made of excess lavender that was stuffed, and you know, people travel to Tasmania of all places, which is a lovely spot to visit, but hard to get to buy these bears, Bobby the Bear, you know. And again, it was partly through, I guess, that interconnectivity of, you know, and in the example of Bobby the Bear, it was happenstance. It wasn't a targeted strategic kind of online campaign, but it was done through I don't think it was WeChat. It might have been Xiaohongshu, one of the other platforms posts. That then everyone, and the person was a girlfriend of a famous director, and that then led to everyone wanting to buy Bobby the Bear. So there's that sort of connectivity. And I think also for a lot of people, perhaps in the States, you know, there are large overseas Chinese populations in, say, San Francisco or the Bay Area or LA and certainly New York. But, you know, Australia, we have 5% of our population identifies as having Chinese heritage. Now, that's not all from mainland China. That's Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, Malaysia, those sorts of places. But, you know, I used to do a lot of work where you said if there's 1.4 million Chinese Australians plus about 1.4 million coming in as tourists and plus 300,000 as students, you know, you're looking at a market that's bigger than some of our states and territories that you can focus into and sell to in that way. So I think what a lot of Australian brands did well was they didn't even realize they were big in China because they were being sold and bought in Australian retail or supermarket or grocery spaces, but then were then also taken back through that. So I think the way within which to kind of connect into, and, you know, obviously WPIC, who's an ACBC member and does a lot of great work in that sort of space, can help some of those brands better engage and better understand how to tidy up and take advantage of some of that knowledge and I guess the interest that Chinese consumers might have for Australian brands.
Tom, very busy guy. I know that we're pretty much out of time that you've got to run. We are super thankful and grateful and blessed to have gotten this time with you that we have had today. I had a bunch of questions left. I'm going to wrap up a couple into one final question. And knowing that we're up against the clock, you can answer that as briefly as you need to. You're based in Australia. So what is the sentiment among the Australian business community towards China? And then the message and the work that the ACBC is delivering in Australia to work with that kind of sentiment and message?
So I think Australian businesses have pragmatic optimism when it comes to China. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think in the past, there was probably some unjustified, rampant optimism. And I think Australian businesses now are, without being risk averse, are kind of more aware of what some of the risks and how best to engage. I think the kind of the big selling stories or the big opportunities for a lot of Australian brands is understanding that China is, there's no single pathway. It's quite complex. You need a series of good advisors or, people in a part of your team and part of your broader team that can help you engage with that. And certainly at ACBC, we're here to support those Australian businesses. We don't do that. We don't do consultancy work, but we can put you in touch with our members that do that sort of work. And I think what we're looking at is just being kind of clear-eyed in terms of what the opportunities are. You know, the mining giants, they're giants and they know what they're doing. They've got great teams. Our big wine companies have got teams on the ground up there. They're doing great stuff. For those that are perhaps looking at re-entering China or thinking about China, I think, again, it's important to read, to engage, to listen to podcasts like this, to come along to ACBC events and just try and understand really what the opportunities are because, you know, it's a great place to do business. And I think that, as I said right at the outset, Australia and China do have, a strong kind of relationship economically. And I think there's been, a growing sense of optimism through the kind of warming of the relationships in this kind of stabilization phase.
It's quite the hike to enter China. But yeah, with a good Sherpa like the ACBC, it's definitely worth the view.
Yeah, that's true.
Tom Parker, National CEO of the Australia China Business Council. Thank you very much for coming on the show. We really appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Todd. Appreciate it.
Okay, for everybody listening to audio only, don't forget to go over to the WPIC YouTube channel and check out our shorts and other information over there. For those of you watching on YouTube, don't forget you can catch the podcast in audio form only on all your favorite podcast platforms. But for me and everybody else at the WPIC team and for Tom Parker, thank you very much for listening today and we'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.